So he was asked to write a book for popular consumption, non-technical, and he said no. He was approaching his 80s, and he was getting tired. But then he had a dream that he was talking at a psychological convention. He was talking to a whole group of people, ordinary people, and they understood him. So the next time the man approached him, he said, okay. And he wrote this book with his collaborators. He did not write the whole book. He wrote the first chapter. It's called Man and His Symbols. He wrote the first chapter, which is called Approach to the Unconscious. And I was dealing with that most of this first week. Why it's important to dream, what the unconscious is. And from my diagram there, you could see that the collective unconscious is an ongoing thing. I made it on purpose a little larger because it's timeless. It reaches beyond your own psyche. That thing there is a psyche. The ego is what mediates between the unconscious and the conscious. And the conscious is just a 1/5 and the rest is 4/5. So it's a pretty large part. And you saw there a little part is personal unconscious. That's the part Freud talked about. But Jung discovered this large body of the collective unconscious, which contains the archetypes. And they are what you see in myths and fairy tales, and they are a creative force and an inner orderedness that is not just sexual and not just a personal repressed material, but the kind of thing you read in mythology and in fairy tales. They're called archetypes. And we'll come to them as I talk. The second chapter deals with myths, and the third one with the process of individuation. This process is what goes on for everybody. It's spiral growth throughout life. You start at birth till death. You never stop growing. You always go over the same road and solve problems over and over again, but always on a slightly higher plane. I mean, we have this image from low to high, but it could also be in an arc. It doesn't really matter. The important thing is that it's a circular path that you go through life with, and that is your individual growth path. It's called individuation. Then symbolism in the visual arts that deals with art. In art of artists, and he shows how the archetypal symbols are used by artists, because many artists are very much in contact with their unconscious, and therefore when they paint or sculpt, they use often, especially modern artists, use these archetypal images. He also shows how there has been a rift since the Middle Ages between the conscious and the unconscious, and that now a lot of this unconscious material is coming out in a very irrational way, so that modern art contains all these things that we just don't understand, precisely because they're so irrational. But they appear in our dreams, and it's important to keep track of your dreams, because it's the only way you can get to know your unconscious directly, or indirectly, if you know what I mean. Your own unconscious will speak to you, and as you write down your dreams, you will see themes and symbols that will be meaningful and can act as guides, as mirrors, as warnings, and as entertainment too, if you don't want to take it too seriously. Today I would like to read to you the dreams that a boy called Henry dreamt, and how they were analyzed by Jacobi, who is Jung's assistant, has written 3 books, and does a marvelous job in showing how these symbols and archetypes, what they mean. And if you're interested, here's a book list of a bibliography in which you'll see some of the other books that have been written. And then I'll throw it open to discussion, and we can talk about dreams people have had. They call me the dream lady here, and everybody stops me and says, Well, I had a weird dream last night. What does it mean? Well, I can't tell you what it means, but I can try to help you find out what it means for you. And, the important thing is that dreams have to mean something personal to you. There's no fixed symbols. That's the big difference between Freud and Jung, that the symbols are not always the same. You dream of a tower, it is not necessarily a phallic symbol. And a cave is not necessarily a womb, but it may be. And in this case, we have a boy, or a young man rather, who is 25 years old, Swiss, very introverted. Now, next week I'll talk a lot about introvert and extrovert. Here I just want to say introverted is someone who takes from the outside world and thinks about his inner life more than he acts on the outside, basically. The energy goes inward. But he was very introverted to the point where he had trouble relating to young women, and even though he was engaged, he couldn't decide to get married. And basically, he wanted to get some help in solving his problems. He was very self-critical, very much reading books by himself, and very intellectual at the expense of his feeling side. He was very tied to his mother, and that held his ego in strength. He couldn't break away from home, period. That's the way to say it. That also meant that he couldn't really get engaged, and so that's why he went to Jolanda Jacoby, who's Jung's assistant, and started an analysis that lasted exactly 9 months, which I thought was rather interesting, 9 months being period for gestation, period of 3 times 3, which is sort of a perfectly balanced figure. Jung goes in a lot for numbers and meanings of numbers as well as shapes. Anyhow, his analysis lasted 9 months, and at the end of which, I'll jump ahead, he was enabled to become engaged and got married, got a fine job, and lived happily ever after. It all worked out very nicely. He was also very, because of his literary background, this is one of many cases that she analyzed. She pulled this one out not as a typical analysis. There's no such thing as a typical analysis, but rather an interesting one or enlightening one. And in any analysis, the initial dream, the first dream that they patient brings in is very significant because his unconscious has been stirred up and the chances are that some of the archetypes will appear. So the analyst always takes a lot of time in analyzing the initial dream, which is the one I will read to you and tell you how she analyzed. It'll give you an idea of how this is done. ask questions as we go along and then we'll have a discussion. At the day after Henry's first visit to me, he had the following dream. I was on an excursion with a group of people I did not know. We were going to a mountain called Sinalvotorn. We only walked about an hour because we were to camp and have some skits or theatricals. I was not given an active part. I should say here in his life he was very passive. As I think I said. I especially remember one performer, a young woman wearing a long flowing robe. It was midday and I wanted to go on to the pass. The others preferred to remain and I went up alone, leaving my equipment behind. However, I found myself right back in the valley and completely lost my orientation. I wanted to return to my party, but I did not know which mountainside I could climb. I was hesitant about asking. Finally, an old woman showed me the way I must go. And for those who've been here before, there's the old, wise old woman. That's an archetype, see? An old woman showed me the way I should go. Then I ascended from a different starting point than our group had used in the morning. It was a matter of turning to the right and then following the mountain slope to return to the party. I climbed along a cogwheel mountain railway. On my left, little cars were constantly passing me, each containing one hidden, bloated little man in a blue suit. I said, "They are dead." I was afraid of other cars coming from behind and kept turning around so as to not be run over. My anxiety was needless. At this point, I had to turn off to the right where the people were awaiting me. They took me to an inn, and there was room at the inn. A cloudburst came. I regretted that my equipment was not there, but I was told not to get them till next morning, and I accepted their advice. That's the end of the dream. Well, you see, it's kind of weird. Now, what does she do with this? She says, he goes to an unknown land. He's climbing a mountain. Climbing a mountain is often symbolic of the journey of life, of a steep or of a difficult task. As you know from hiking, it's no easy task to go up to Holden, for example. Now, it's symbolic of life's tasks and of great difficulty. The nature of the path often tells you what your life's path is like. She likens it to Pilgrim's Progress, among other things. And it also means that he's climbing from his unconscious to increased consciousness. He's becoming more aware of himself. She makes a lot out of the fact that the mountain he climbs has the word red in it. Red has symbolic significance and often means passion. The colors, by and large, mean, if they appear in a significant point, can be used to see what they mean. Blue, it's often thinking. White is purity. Red is feeling or passion. And green is hope or early spring growth, kind of growth of the psyche. She says that it's rather interesting. There's a double paradox because the woman in the, he was asked, who does this old woman remind you of? And he said the old woman reminded him of a woman in a painting. I don't know if you're familiar with the Isle of the Dead. That's a picture that hangs in many a schoolroom in Germany. It's this one here. It's very hard to see. But in it, there is a shadowy figure of a woman that looks like, it could either be a woman or a man. And so she makes a lot of the fact that this woman is unidentified. But it also reminded her of a woman in a, it reminded him of a woman in a play, and this woman was definitely the wise old woman giving him advice as to where to go. Next, he has to go to another side of the mountain, which means he has to, according to her, reverse his old attitudes and climb from a different side. So he has to reverse his old attitudes and try again. He goes to the right side of the track, and in general, when you go to the right side in a dream, you're going towards consciousness. To the left is to unconsciousness. This is a thing that they found out from analyzing many, many dreams. I couldn't say if this is absolutely true, but it has been for many people. Again, it does depend on the individual, but by and large, this is true. These little cars that come behind him with the bloated little men are the things he's afraid of. And she says here that Henry was afraid of what was behind his ego, what was something shadowy and dead and blue and ugly, maybe his own shadow, which brings me to the concept of the shadow, because each one of us has in here a whole realm of dark things that are completely unacceptable to us. Things, the shadow that we can't acknowledge our darker side, devilish impulses, murderous impulses. that we can also, again, only know by how we project them and through our dreams. Coming to terms with the shadow often means a rebirth, beginning of a rebirth, because as you own your shadow, then you can reach a higher level, or you can reach a new awareness. That's the most important thing. It is said that they are dead, these little men in the carts. Jung makes a lot out of any voice or any message, no matter where it comes from. In this case, this part of him is either dead or should be dead or should be left behind. And often everything you dream of can be parts of your own psyche, especially if you don't know the people. That's another rule of thumb. If you don't know the people you're dreaming of, it's probably parts of your own self. If you know the person, it could be that you're dreaming about the specific person. When the cloudburst comes, this was very interesting to me, I'd forgotten this. She says, it's a way of making the earth fertile when it rains. And rain in mythology often is a symbol of fertility. So the cloudburst means a solution is about to be found. The earth is being washed by rain, it's going to be fertile, a new growth will come out of that. So even though it had a scary aspect that it was a cloudburst, the rain could wash away some of the bad things. And Henry submits a second time and goes to another way and finds his friends, which are his peers, and the end is, what was the last thing? The end is pretty good. I accepted their advice. So there is the beginning or the foreshadowing of the fact, which he did in real life, that he went out into the world and was able to accept the collective pattern of his peers. In other words, he got married and did the thing that one's supposed to do. So much for the initial dream. The whole chapter deals with the process of his particular analysis, but I think you might read that for yourselves. This was just a way to show you how a dream can be analyzed. He was asked to give associations. Now, the first thing you would do is to write down your own dream if you were doing this. And I would say that the best way is to remind yourself as you go to sleep that you will remember it. How many here remember their dreams? Well, that's pretty good. Most people dream every night, as you know, but they don't remember the dream. You can't control what you will dream, but you can remember it. And if you have a pad of paper and a little bit of time as you awaken, right after before the alarm rings, preferably. Or right after the alarm, not jumping out of bed, but just letting it come back and writing it down quickly, then you can just leave it. In fact, it's best to leave it. Look at it much later. But when you do look at it, then you can begin to look and see what these symbols could mean and make some association with this. Somebody brought me a dream about a man smoking a cigar and her cutting the cigar each time he puffed. Well, a cigar is often a Freudian symbol. Well, after I asked her a few things, the cigar was a very pleasant memory of a time they all sat together and this particular person smoked a cigar. And of course the cigar got smaller as they were sitting around. In fact, he implied that they had such a conversation that every time he said something significant, he puffed hard and the cigar got smaller. So you see, it didn't have this castrating implication, but rather a good social association. So you try to get the association of what this particular person or thing meant. Then you try to look at the shape of the room or the shape, any shape that comes up, because as I mentioned yesterday and as I will talk again on Monday, the mandala is a basic shape that arises in the process of individuation. A circle and the square and the cross all figure in this. They're used as aids to meditation, but they're also symbols that rise from the unconscious. So then you associate to what comes to mind, and you also try to remember either a mythology or a fairy tale that comes to mind. You will be surprised how you may be dreaming of something that ties in with a fairy tale, because as I said, in fairy tales and mythology, the archetypes rise or are embodied in them. And it's very important to realize that they're like charged atoms. In fact, at one point, Jung says, understanding the archetype is almost equivalent to splitting the atom. There's so much energy in them. And that this is psychic energy. And this releases energy for your consciousness, releases energy for work, for creativity. So there's another very good reason for understanding it. However, there's a word of caution, just as with the splitting of the atom. If you have a dream that is too overpowering or too strange or too explosive, and especially in an analysis, if you interpret it too fast, the consciousness can be flooded and you can temporarily lose your sense of bearing and go into a sort of psychotic episode. However, that's the skill of an analyst, that he wouldn't overanalyze it. If you analyze your own dreams, there's hardly any danger that you would do this, because the psyche is self-regulating, and that's one of its beauties. It allows you to become conscious of only so much as you can bear. And this reminds me of the scripture that Christ never tempts you beyond the strength. He will also give you the strength to bear the temptation. Does anybody know that particular scripture? Yeah. So that in the same sense, you never are asked to bear more psychic material than you can cope with, by and large, if you allow natural things to take their place. So that some archetypes will remain locked. And I have collected my dreams since 1950, and I've looked them over and over and over. And these things open just like blossoms in their own time. And some things that I've understood, haven't understood 10 years ago, I understand today, you see. So there's a built-in safeguard, yes?
I have that scripture in my wallet.
Oh, yes, please.
It says, no temptation has overtaken you that is not common to man. God is faithful, and he will not let you be tempted beyond your strength. But with the temptation will also provide the way of escape, that you may be able to endure it.
Thank you.
That's 1 Corinthians 10:13.
1 Corinthians 10:15. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's very applicable, because also in each problem there's the seed of the solution. Now there's the dynamics of your psyche too, that in the darkness precedes the dawn. So when you get to know your darkest side, you're also on the verge of rebirth. But when you're at the highest summit, you often have to go back down into the valley. So that's a continuing thing. That's very helpful. So that the psyche balances itself out, and as you look at your dreams, you make your associations with what it means. You see, you can begin to recognize which dreams are just parts of yesterday or little remnants of your life that you lived yesterday or the day before. And in New Guinea, Carol Nolte said, they call these dreams something-nothing dreams. They're okay, they're dreams, but they're not very profound. On the other hand, there are those big dreams that, you know, jolt you and that you remember, even if you don't write them down, though it is better to write them down, that often have a white light or warmth or a wonderful feeling or a very terrifying feeling associated with them. Nightmares that wake you up. But those are dreams true. Those dreams you should really look at. They're vital. They have these archetypes. And so those are the ones maybe that you will find repeated, and that a theme goes through the dreams as you look at them over a period of time. Yeah.
What is a process that goes on? I've had experiences where I may be thinking about something during the day, a question or a problem, and can't come up with an answer or a resolution. And then sometime during the night, I wake up all of a sudden, and there's the answer. The most dramatic is actually a chemistry problem. I struggled with that and simply gave up on it, went to bed. The next morning I woke up, I had the answer, I knew it was right, I picked out paper and pencil and wrote it down, it was right. What's the process? How does that work? How in the world does that function?
Well, I think partly that all the parts of the problem sink down and your ego is not distracted. When you're awake, you have to pay attention to so many things. In fact, one exercise we could do would be to just to close our eyes and then describe the person sitting next to you and see how much you have remembered without even looking at them. I mean, I'm aware of all kinds of things. Now, when you're asleep, you're only paying attention to the unconscious. And if you've been thinking about it all day long and it's uppermost in your mind, it can work, it continues to work and finds a solution. And the greatest example of this is, what's his name, the great chemist, the benzene ring?
That's Kikola, yeah. A Hungarian chemist who thought of the benzene ring in a dream.
Uh-huh.
He did not, people had the sense of nuclear, of atomic structure, but they couldn't make benzene work right. I'd love to draw benzene on the board, but I won't. Anyway, he saw it. he saw it on the board. Let me mention two others, may I?
Yeah, go ahead.
Elias Howe, who invented the sewing machine, which, believe it or not, women were so reluctant to use in the 19th century, saw it as a dream. And in the dream, a snake's eye kept moving from tail to head. And then it moved back, and then he thought of the idea of the needle. The sewing machine was impossible until he moved the hole down to the point from the other end of the ordinary needle. And it was came to him as a snake with a movable eye back and forth, one end to the other. The other is Tesla, the great Yugoslav man who invented alternating current. And that some important concept of that came to him as intertwining snakes. I guess, but back to the benzene ring, which is your example.
Yeah, that's great.
But here is a point I would suggest, if you don't mind, that the benzene ring, which in some respects as exciting as your own idea of chemistry perhaps, is meaningless, except you are a scientist, and therefore this came to you. This benzene ring, which is like, you know how it looks, it has the carbon and then the double bond alternating, was meaningful to him only because he was a great chemist, a scientist, and therefore he could interpret accordingly. He was working on the problem. So the analogy would be that if I happen to dream of something that a man in the Sanskrit language was thinking of, it would be meaningless to me.
But a Sanskrit scholar would be meaningful,
scholar,
yeah.
If I just saw Sanskrit written in my dream, it would be meaningless to me, but to the great Sanskrit scholar, perhaps, it would be so wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Anyhow, that's possible. Go ahead. Yeah, I'll be there.
Could I follow up on that then? This brings to mind another point, another question, and I would agree with what you said, not knowing anything about it, but that's kind of the way I felt about it. This then certainly means that whatever influences are around us, which means that this is what's on our mind to a large extent, does really influence us, and it can lead to certain outcomes, which ties right back to this thing of TV programs, which mm-hmm. people are totally, constantly bombarded with. It's bound to affect them.
Yes.
This is a thing that comes to my mind when I think about these dreams, this particular dream, mm-hmm. and others of that type that I've had.
Mm-hmm.
So where do we get how can psychologists, learned people, come up with the conclusion that it has no effect?
I don't know, but I think they're finding more and more that it does have effect, and they're trying to reduce the violence, and the violent shows. There is a commission now working on it. But like everything, the lobbies that are selling Fruit Loops, etc., is a little stronger than the lobbies of the psychologists who say that it has an adverse effect on the psyche. But I think we'll get there. I think people are beginning to turn off, not turn off, but just watch less TV. And one reason I think we feel so great at Holden is it's one thing we don't have. And last night's skit showed how really boring. I mean, the skit was delightful, but TV was really boring, isn't it? But it does affect you, right? You had a question.
Well, I was just going to comment that, like you were saying about the Sanskrit, it seems like you kind of said it yourself, the input, he said, things fed into it. Like, I wouldn't, like, chemistry to me is like Greek. So I would lay down when I dream how the animals would, or whatever, you know, I mean, it seems like whatever was being fed into you would be what would be.
Well, now we could bring that up to why it is important to teach children fairy tales, and certainly more important even, teach them Bible stories, because they sink into their unconscious, and they're very, very important. And I think it's just essential that they have that. And in education, it's essential that they memorize some things, that they have this knowledge. And Erwin Weber was telling us in his Life of Luther how he had to memorize, he knew the Bible memorized by heart. You see, in those days, that was part of the way people studied and learned. And even though memorization may be terribly dull, it does ensure that you have this, you know, really there available. And like, the verse came to me, but I didn't have it memorized, see? So nowadays we're a little less on memory work. Go ahead.
Would we be inclined to remember also the negative feelings that we had while memorizing? Or would we only remember the memory verse?
I think some negative feelings block out the memorization. Because I know I've memorized lots of stuff in confirmation, and I can't recite it to you now. And if I had truly memorized it, I should be able to.
You memorize it, but you didn't learn it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, the trend now in education is with so many more facts being available to every grade level, it's impossible to learn just even barely even the basics anymore. In education, the trend is toward learning how to find where to find the answer, mm-hmm, instead of knowing everything, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, where can we go to find a picture of the benzene, you know, instead of, you know, I'm not going to draw on the board, but it wouldn't mean beans to me. But if I wanted to know where to find it, I could ask him, you know, okay, I think that's what, and that's where a wider diversity of input can enter our psyche, our subconscious, mm-hmm, whatever, if we try to concentrate on different, realizing where we can
Are we coming to the point where everybody's going to have their little computer with them and everything will be available? I think we're moving in that direction, because I'm always amazed at, you know, what the computer will give you at a moment's punch of a few minutes, a few keys.
I think we have to be careful that we don't stifle creativity in that process. So
that's just it.
Well, I think sort of education, like especially mathematics, it's not going to where you have a computer all the time or you have to look up. I mean, you're just learning the basic mathematical problems from, and then there you can go on, you know, you can make any other problem. I mean, you know, as long as you know the basic ones, not just, you know, addition, subtraction. I mean, like if you want to know some theory or something, you know the basic part of the theory, and then you can build in your own mind the rest of it. You don't have to have it all memorized out.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I would say it's all... You know, in the future they're all going to go to the computer and just have that right there, because that will still be taught, I think.
Yeah.
I think you have to ensure that you're differentiating between things that are memorized and what you might perhaps mean by knowledge in its broader form, because what you commit to memory is only a very minor aspect of any of knowledge. For example, if you had memorized where to go to look to find a benzene ring, that wouldn't provide you with any understanding what the benzene ring is or what it really means. And that's what the computer bank, what the memory bank in the computer does. All is that is stored in there are binary digits, and they just contain information. But as you rightly said, it has nothing to do with the question of creativity. And I wonder on the gentleman's question here, I could perhaps ask Al, it's very easy for me to see how one might solve a problem in a dream where it's largely geometrical.
Yes.
For example, you gave us a very good one. And you remember Linus Pauling tells us that he's developed right in there. Tells us that he came upon the helical genetic code arrangement by bending a piece of paper.
Yes.
And perhaps in our dreams we perceive geometrical things, and maybe other things too. But to jump from there to conceiving, let's say, an abstract multidimensional theory, such as relativity or quantum mechanics, perhaps that can be done too, but it would be much more of a startling thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Al, was your solution, was it a geometrical one, or was it an abstract mathematical or a chemical problem?
It would have to go in a geometrical category.
And I just sort of intuitively feel that we'd find more examples of that, where the mind in the dream wouldn't be exercised as deeply as trying to create, let's say, a new mathematical theorem. Although probably the mathematician might have virtually solved it, and then in his dream he might get the last elements and, you know, spring mm-hmm. up with the Eureka business.
I think I've had experiences where I've come, where things have come to me where, well, they're not in the geometric category at all. They'd be simply, purely and simply, problems that I've had or questions that I've struggled with, and answers have come. And in that area, there's no proof like there is in mathematics, but at least it's, in my mind, it has been a satisfactory outlook for me, or a satisfactory answer in terms of viewpoint or whatever.
My problem is I snore, so I don't get anything creative.
I would say what you said another way. The epistle of Paul to the Romans and to the Galatians and the Ephesians that Luther worked with such care cannot be reduced to a bumper sticker. Something, and dreams are never come, I believe, with the elaborateness of the care of Paul's epistles to the Romans. They're often geometric and they're short and they're a lack of bumper sticker, but oftentimes they're that even a phrase can be magnificent at some point, but never the elaborate discourse in my experience of Paul's epistle to the Romans.
Well, this just confirms the fact that the purpose of dreaming is to stir up the unconscious to yield creative energy, psychic energy, that will bring answers, bring things together. It is kind of the intuitive, irrational thing that brings elements that are all around together, and if you've been struggling with it, the answer will come. But the elements have to be there. The elements have been done consciously. And differentiation is a concept that the consciousness does. It takes one block of a concept and breaks it down into parts, and then it can get lost among the parts. Then your dream can pull them back together again, you see. Because essentially what happens is that you have a concept. Let's take Holden Village. Before you came here, those especially who come the first time, it was a vague concept. Then you come to Holden, you get to know specific people, you have specific experiences. When you go away, Holden Village means something very different. And now comes the beautiful part. When you come back, you build on that original thing. You see, you're going in a spiral a second time around. You have changed a little. You're bringing something new. You get something else. And it always is marvelous. Small commercial for Holden. Any other questions? No, go ahead.
I find that when I'm struggling with problems and trying to find solutions, but also that when I'm learning at the same time, I dream much more than when I'm just, I don't have to struggle with any problems.
Mm-hmm. That's another proof of the theory, that when you're stirred up with a problem or with big emotions, like at the time of a wedding or a death or a birth, you often have very significant dreams because, you know, you're just stirred up. And when you're just kind of floating along, you often don't have such significant dreams. And that's where the psyche works as a whole. And remember the fact that it compensates. Always compensates for something that is lacking, which also again explains how it can bring a solution. It is a very dynamic thing. It is frightening, but it's also very dynamic and positive in that it supplies something that isn't there, something that you just can't know, because it's all kind of there, and it will rise up in dreams in one way or another.
In my case, it was conscious brain power that was lacking.
Yes.
Are you saying then that dreams tend, the psyche, it tends to be a purposeful activity?
Yes.
Rather than a haphazard, random type of...
Now this is exactly the paradox. The dream itself, as you saw the one of Henry that I read, is rather bizarre. What could be more bizarre than little bloated men in railroad carriages, you know? But the message and the meaning is quite purposeful, as you said. In fact, the psyche is often, the unconscious is often ahead of you. And that's why some dreams seem prophetic or anticipatory, because it points the way. Because I think I drew it here a little beyond, it's timeless, you see. So it kind of reaches out. ESP is in that general area. You can be more sensitive to events that are out there, and Jung even has a theory of synchronicity that psychic and physical events run along in two sort of more or less parallel, not causally related streams, and that through the archetype they can touch and become meaningfully connected. So we call happy coincidences, meaningful coincidences, and that's why some dreams are actually quite purposeful. Many dreams are, but some are more so than others. I mean, again, the dreams true would be more so than just little surface dreams.
Okay, some are, but all right, what about dreams that out of which nothing really seems to develop? Or dreams that maybe wishing, in your dream you see a condition which in real life does not exist. For example, I have had several dreams of a relative of mine who is invalided, and I have dreamed three or four times that I've seen her getting ready to go to a dance, or that I've walked in the room and said, "Aha, you're up and walking," so on. And you see, now that must be some kind of a wish.
Yes, it does.
But you see, it doesn't really jive with reality.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is there a purpose, or is that just the mind kind of wandering and thinking or wishing? Or
but doesn't each person have their own interpretation of their own dream?
Yeah, there is that, your own interpretation.
That's what she's doing.
Well, your interpretation, see, in order to really get at the purpose of it, we'd have to get all the associations around it. Maybe we can do that later, if you want to. Usually, you'll be surprised, there is some kind of purpose, and what appears as a simple wish may have other connections, which I cannot reach at the moment. But in general, it is fairly purposeful, but sometimes it is a simple wish. This is what Freud started with. And most of the personal unconscious, that is something very readily available to you, probably have wished this consciously as well, so that it is not surprising to dream of that. We're talking of a slightly lower level where bizarre and irrational things come up which you have never thought of even, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Another subject following what was mentioned over here about coming up with things that, I forget how it was, so if somebody said something about Sanskrit, if they happened to see that mm-hmm. in a dream, I guess they wouldn't have any idea what it was. But what about glossolalia, or speaking in tongues?
Speaking in tongues.
Now, I've read some supposedly scientific reports about it, and I guess it does really happen. And I have read about instances where individuals have spoken in a foreign language, in a language in which they have had no training, no contact, and it has been fluent in that particular language. Is that true, or if it is, what is a how does the mind work, or is this directly the spirit working, or
yeah.
You see, this is a difficult question, but that's a question that comes to mind.
Yeah, now that's very controversial and not very clear. Well, no, I mean the answers are not very clear. I really don't know too much, except that I know that it happens, that it's a gift of the Holy Spirit, but one of the lesser gifts, and that it could happen that they had training as a child sometimes, and that it has sunk down, and they may have the ability to talk in that foreign language. But if they speak in tongues, that is irrelevant that they be understood, isn't it? It seems that they just talk, they praise the Lord in wild syllables.
Apparently some of it is just babble, but just also babble. There is some actual spoken words that have that are very clear and distinct in some other language.
Yeah.
I don't know that it happened, but I read it. And it happens, of course, not only amongst Christians. It happens in any, it can happen in any area. In fact, there are other peoples who have no Christian or religious, well, have no Christian training, but have other religions.
Carol, do you have an answer to that?
No, I'm going to change the subject. Is there a difference between visions and dreams? As far as psychologists?
Yeah, I'll come right to that. I really don't have the answer, but I'll think about it, and maybe I'll come up with it next week.
There are tapes in the library on speaking in tongues.
Thank you. Okay. Vision, is there a difference between vision and dreams? Yes, you're conscious when you have a vision. You're not asleep. In other words, your ego is still there, but it is very lowered.
A vision. Would be another example. A mirage would be another example.
Yes, a mirage or a hallucination.
You're wide awake.
Yes, you are awake and you see this figure or the shimmering water in the desert, and it is quite real to you. But it is also the conscious awareness of an archetype without being asleep. Really, that's the only way I could say it.
Would that be a pre-dream?
That can happen in a pre-dream state.
Oh, that happens to me a lot.
Yeah?
I've even heard voices, which I thought I was, actually thought I was, didn't think I was asleep. And yet, I've been hassling with a big decision on. I had an opportunity to transfer with a company that I worked for to Florida, and everything was, well, it was a marvelous opportunity, and I really couldn't see anything wrong with it. And but I had to come up with a decision. I had two more days left, and I was in the process. I thought I was just falling asleep, and but I suppose I really was asleep, but I just thought I was just drifting off. And I heard my father's voice call me from the other end of the house, and three different times. And I sat up in bed and I just, you know, broke out into a cold sweat. It frightened me, you know. And, well, then I knew he wasn't there or anything like that. And then the next day I thought about that so much, and I thought that there just had to be a reason that I heard that. Well, after I thought about it, the way I figured it out was that my dad was calling me, not wanting me to go. That was the only thing I could figure out. As it turned out, I didn't take the job. And as it turned out, I was really glad that I hadn't, because a fellow that was the head of the plant where I was working had gone to California. And about 3 months later, he was moved from California to Florida. And he was an absolute bear to work with.
Mm-hmm.
And it would have been jumping out of the frying pan into the fire. I was glad when he had left, because, I mean, he was in a position where he had to work with people a lot, and he was not a people person. And so
and it ended up, this guy ended up in Florida. And had I have gone.
Yeah.
That was my reason for not going, because my folks had just recently retired, and they had been business people, and I had not really gotten to know my parents, you know, because they were so busy always.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well.
Well, as I said earlier with Henry, when you hear a voice, pay attention. And apparently, when you hear it three times, certainly pay attention.
Yeah.
Carol?
Yeah, I'll go back a little bit. Then visions have more ego involvement, right?
A little bit, yes.
A little bit more art in vision or something. Is there any kind of correlation between the piety of a person and the religious elements in either dreams and or visions? Is there a typing, a kind of people that have visions? Or a time when they have visions?
Okay, now you can more or less consciously lower your level of consciousness by meditating or by means of hypnotic devices, you know, self-hypnosis kind of. Lowering the stimuli around you, darkening the room, focusing, concentrating on one thing, you know.
It's a mystic experience.
Kind of. Mm-hmm. But I don't know of any relation between piety and religious type visions, but I do think that what your mind feeds on will be out in the vision.
Yeah.
And what your problem is, somebody said you were stirred up, you were struggling with a problem, and then you had a lot of dreams. Similarly, when you're struggling with a major decision, as in your case, or a major problem, you're likely to have dreams or visions. I think it's a question of not sensitivity so much as the thinness of the ego, of how much the ego is willing to let the unconscious rise directly.
The reason I asked that question about the visions and dreams and religious experience was that once I had a class of very bright students in English literature, and I gave an assignment for each of them to make a presentation to the class as one of their, in lieu of a paper. A very bright girl was giving a lecture and lesson on Shaw's St. John.
Mm.
She began that by not even referring to St. John at all, but by asking the question of a class of high school students in a public high school of little to no religious experience. How many have you had any direct or experience or knowledge of somebody who has had a vision, and almost the entire class raised their hands. And I was so shocked that, you know, I couldn't even imagine that, you know.
Yeah, I can't either.
Most of them of very secular background. As a matter of fact, in that community, most of them have very secular Jewish background. So I was glad that.
Oh, yeah, that is amazing.
So.
Hmm. Yeah.
It seems like in a lot of my dreams, there's always one significant thing. It's either like colors or people that I hardly know. I know them, but I, you know, like in my life, I've said one word to them or something. Why is it that lots of times there's these people that I hardly know wearing very significant colors? Because
well,
I didn't know there was significant colors, so you said something about it. Now that I think about it.
Well, what else did I say? That when you don't know the people, it's probably parts of yourself. See, the less you know the person, the more likely it is aspects of yourself. Jung maintains that everything you dream about is yourself, but there are certain dreams where I think the real person is the real thing you're dreaming about. It's sort of tenuous, but most likely it is parts of yourself, these people you hardly know in their various colors. And maybe next week when we talk about types and functions, it will all fall into place, hopefully. Yeah?
Are you going to touch at all about people flying in their dreams?
Well, I can just say right now that contrary to what Freud says, it's not sexual intercourse, but flying on a higher intellectual or spiritual plane. See, they differ very much in their interpretation.
You're playing post office on a higher plane.
Yeah, although if you were taking flying lessons and
yes, exactly. Thank you. I was just going to.
You were concentrating on getting a license, I think, then you might well dream
Thank
about
you.
Flying.
Thank you.
Would
yeah.
have a different meaning.
That's precisely it. If you're a pilot or you're taking flying lessons or something, your dream of flying would be so different than if you're just an ordinary earthbound
yes,
person.
Right,
and that's a personal difference there.
In the first case, it's a feeling of soaring above everything and so on. It's not the mechanics of flying, but mm-hmm. if you're learning how to fly, your dreaming of flying is how you're going to coordinate those motions and the results you get.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a different aspect of the same thing.
Yeah.
I want to ask you a question. Is there anything to, is it possible that, and I'm not well read in this at all, but is the essence of dreams, is there something to be learned about the essence of dreams by examining what one might consider to be the minimum conscious requirement to have a dream? And I'll tell you what I mean. I think I perceive that animals have dreams. Is this correct or not?
Yes,
I think so.
It seems to be obvious in
yeah.
you know, what's
yeah.
up. Therefore, you don't have to be a human being to have dreams. Now, you could go a step further and say, do you have to have any reasoning power to have dreams? If so, how much?
Oh, see, I don't think, yeah, I think it's precisely because you turn off your reasoning power and your consciousness that you dream. I think, as the diagram indicates, it's the lower level, the level of the psyche that we have in common with the whole animal kingdom from whence arise the dream.
Does this mean dreams essentially are illogical, or they can have some logic with them?
They're essentially illogical.
I'm getting at is I recently reread von Neumann's book called The Computer and the Human Mind, and apparently there is still a real argument with many bright people on both sides as to whether the computer can think. I happen to, in my definition of thinking, I happen to be on the side that says no. But some people say a computer has to have, if it doesn't have a consciousness, therefore it cannot think in the way we think of intelligent thinking, but you might ask whether a computer could dream. Now,
I don't think so.
I think it would float that course.
To, to treat your question a little bit lightly, I use a computer a little bit, and we say garbage in and garbage out.
Right.
Sometimes with a human mind, it can be garbage in and ecstasy out.
But remember, we all know, you know and I know, and anybody who works with computers knows that a computer can learn. A computer definitely can learn, but that's not the same thing as thinking.
No.
Yeah.
You see, he can learn in the same way that you can learn by rote, but he's not creative. He can't take the element from here and there and put them together in a new thing, but he can learn to put 2 and 2 is 4, or maybe 4 and 4 is 8. Maybe 8 and 8 is 16.
Wow. The computer can't. Well, maybe what you mean by thinking, it can't be creative. It can't come up with a whole new program.
Yeah, but it's so close to that.
It is close.
When you say learn, you can give a computer a program, and you can tell it. Now, correct all your mistakes and do better. And there are a number of examples where new theorems have been produced by a computer. And incidentally, one of the biggest contradictions is this, that one of the theorems that was developed, strictly mathematical, it continued to fail until the guy, the mathematician, got the idea. He compared the computer to the human mind. He said, well, what's different? Well, one of the things was that we are not perfect. Our system is not perfect. And we make mistakes. So he actually programmed an imperfect thing into the computer. And the computer, by learning those mistakes, came up with the answer.
Uh-huh.
When it was required to be perfect, it failed.
Oh. That's a great sermon there.
Yes. But I believe you're right. I don't think it's creativity.
I'm curious how we would feel if we found out that the computer could. I'm not so much worried at the moment. I think you're right that it's very close to it. But I think I sense how afraid we are that it may.
There is a great deal of insecurity on some people's part this way, yeah. And it's interesting also that the computer memory works in nanoseconds. We're talking about billions of seconds. We can't possibly match that. On the other hand, as you say, you have to program it. And secondly, if you count the cells of the human brain, you know, none of our computers are within 10 orders or much more than the magnitude of the amount of cells we have in our mind.
It's the imagination.
We can't get them all together.
Still, it took the imagination and the creativeness of the programmer to program in the mistakes or the imperfections into the computer.
Well, we too learned by mistakes because they had rats trained to go only the perfect way. They blocked off all the blind alleys. Then they opened the blind alleys. That poor rat almost went crazy. Then they trained the rats to explore blind alleys. And when they knew which ones were the blind alleys, they learned it very quickly. And then they never made, when they blocked them off and then opened them again, they did not make as many mistakes. They learned the maze much better. So we need to make the mistakes to learn, which is very important.